Honestly, you know, sometimes I fiddle with the details, like, is this thing working? You know, while I'm thinking about Pugeni and his mom, and I'm like, who the hell cares? Like, honestly. But life is kind of this weird blend, right? The things that we can touch and work with and influence and impact, and the things that we can't, the things that we kind of care about with our whole hearts and can't make happen, the things that matter to us, like breath, that we take for granted. It's just sort of completely every day till it's not. This is kind of this wacky blender, right? Steve, the story you shared this morning, I was all queued up to ask you how it feels to be responsible for almost killing Jimmy Carter, but anyway, sure, you know, it's not like who cares, but it's that, right? Like, meanwhile, there's this community and this, anyway. So it's complicated. It's beautiful and difficult and complicated. Last week, our community time expanded and expanded and expanded until we used up our allotted time together, talking with and praying for and listening to one another. And that was so lovely. And I'm so grateful for the way that this part of our life together keeps, I think I'm going to use the word growing, by which I don't just mean taking up more time. I mean growing in its freedom and its substance. I think that's very beautiful, very good. I'm grateful for that. One of the things that we did at the end of that time last week, for those of you that were here, you may remember, those of you that weren't, a little catch-up, is we spent a little bit of time with a Bruce Cockburn song that I invited us to approach as a prayer. But it's a different kind of prayer, a prayer not where we're talking to God, which we, you know, sometimes do and call prayer, but a kind of prayer where God is speaking to us and we get to listen to something about the essential nature of the divine being spoken to us, something that might be a comfort to us or a help to us. So that's a presumptuous thing to do, right? To say, listen to these words that were written by a human being, in this particular case, the songwriter Bruce Cockburn. Listen to these as though they were God talking to you. So that's kind of presumptuous, just right out of the chute. And then beyond that, I think there's an inherent danger in doing something like that, which is that we tend to treat God as a superhuman, right? So these images that we have of God are important to us because they open our imagination. It'd be pretty hard to operate without them, actually. To imagine God as everything and nothing is not very satisfying to most humans. There's sort of this thin slice of the philosophical wedge who might find that really engaging, but most of us are like, that's just a little too vague. And so these images that we make up of who God is really matter. They also really limit, right? All of a sudden, there's this distinct possibility that our experience of God is boundaried by our own imagination, that that's actually what we think God is, that we actually think God is what we imagine God is, and that that's the whole story, which is absurd. Like, who needs that God, really? I do not need a God the size of my imagination. But I need my imagination to engage with the divine. Yeah, right? A little bit complicated. But also very much our human experience. So, we're going to revisit, that's all preamble, yeah? We're going to revisit the Cockburn song as the divine inviting us into something. Not because I think God would say these words or God would say any particular words, but because I think that beauty, among other things, is a place and a way in which God does speak to us. And there's a beautiful invitation in this song for us. We'll talk more about it sort of at the end of the talky bit. But for now, that would be my invitation to you. In whatever way you find it easiest to listen to these words as though the divine was acknowledging the challenges of your life, of our lives, of the lives of people we've talked about and thought about together this morning, and then inviting us into rest with God. Okay? It sings better than it speaks, so if the rhyme feels clunky, go home and listen to the song. It's called Southland of the Heart. When the wild-eyed dogs of day-to-day come snapping at your heels, and there's so much coming at you that you don't know how to feel, when they've taken all your money and then come back for your clothes, when your hands are full of thorns but you can't quit groping for the rose, in the southland of the heart, where night blooms perfume the breeze, lie down. Take your rest with me. When thoughts you've tried to leave behind keep sniping from the dark, when the fire burns inside you but you jump from every spark, when your heart's beset by memories you wish you'd never made, when the sun comes up an enemy and nothing gives you shade, in the southland of the heart, where the saints go lazily, lie down. Take your rest with me. When the preacher lays his insight down and claims to lead the blind, when those you trust just get you hooked and trifle with your mind, when the nightmare is creeping closer and your wheels are in the mud, when everything's ambiguous except the taste of blood, in the southland of the heart, there's no question of degree. Lie down, take your rest with me. In the southland of the heart, everyone was always free. Lie down, take your rest with me. I have the distinct advantage in a situation like this of having the words in front of me, of having spent lots of time with the song, of having thought about this for a couple of weeks. So there are things that come out of this for me that are different just because of all that. But one of the things I wanted to point out that really gets to me in this song is the evolving chorus. The Southland image that Coburn's using, of course, is the deep south, the blooms, the perfumed air of the south that, if you've never experienced it, is just still a compelling image. If you have experienced it, then you probably have an olfactory memory of this. But the chorus sort of unfolds about the Southland. And there's this phrase, in the southland of the heart, and then there's these three unfolding phrases, where the saints go lazily, and then the next chorus says, where there's no question of degree, and then the last chorus says, where everyone was always free. See, this is a fascinating image, not least of all because the south that Coburn is painting here has not historically always been anything like free, nor gone lazily, nor been able to rest. And so what's he on about? Well, I wanted us to start in this place of being invited to an experience of rest in the midst of struggle because I want to talk about a particular theme that I feel like culturally we're sort of surrounded by these days. And I've mentioned this lots of times before. I keep saying we'll stop and take a closer look, you know, another day, blah, blah, blah. So I thought maybe this morning I would begin to do that. So in some ways what I want to do this morning is just open a conversation. I want to get something started. The theme that I'm talking about is fear. Not the kind of fear that we might think of as good fear, right? Not the kind of fear that saves our lives. It's not the fear that keeps us from touching hot elements or, you know, driving down Portage at 160 kilometers an hour or acting like gravity has nothing to do with us. Those fears arguably are necessary and good. We would be dead without them, probably fairly short order. I'm talking here about this vague but pervasive fear that seems to me to be characterizing so many of our human experiences and interactions these days. More and more, it feels like fear is a central feature in our politics, in our social discourse, in our relationships, and in our religion. And there are a lot of cultural observers who have pointed out that many of the features of this phenomenon of fear do not seem to square very well with the observable and measurable realities of the time. Now, having said that, there are things to fear, for sure. Sherry Ledbetter, a researcher at Chapman University, this is an American survey in 2015. And according to that survey, the top fears of people in the U.S. in 2015 had to do with things like government corruption, cyber terrorism, tracking of personal information, terrorist attacks, bio warfare, identity theft, and economic collapse. Now, we could recognize in those things some unique features of the American cultural landscape at that time. But if we did the survey in Canada, I think similar themes would show up, undercurrents would be shared. I do find myself, when I read that list, sort of harboring this ironic hope that Canadian list might include things like the fear of disastrous outcomes from climate change, or things that at least suggest that we're thinking beyond our own borders. But in any case, you can look at a list like that and recognize legitimate concerns. It's not that our fears are baseless. Having said that, I think by almost any measure, we're better off than we've ever been. And so we need to kind of wrestle with this a little bit. One of the best-known contemporary Western aphorisms about fear comes to us courtesy of Franklin Roosevelt, who famously said, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." Now, aside from the all-or-nothing nature of that little soundbite, it's either this or that, right? That's why it's survived this long, probably. It's memorable. So there's that, but the saying is also interesting to me because when Roosevelt said it, what was happening around him culturally is that the nation's banks were collapsing, one in four workers was unemployed, Hitler had just become the Chancellor of Germany, and the life expectancy for an adult was about 45 years of age. We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Today, the life expectancy for an adult is about 70, so that's a global figure, not a North American figure. The North American figure is higher. In 1900, in some American cities, as many as 30% of children were dying before they were a year old. Today, that number is less than 1%. And globally, it's less than 5%. And at that same time, the majority of the world's population, over 50%, lived in extreme poverty. And today, that number is less than 15%. And so, globally speaking, generally speaking, we live longer, we hurt less, we earn more, and measurably, we are more afraid than we used to be. So it does stir, I think, the legitimate line of inquiry of what's up with that. I am not going to attempt to resolve that question, but I do want to point towards some themes that might help us to explore it, hopefully productively. So if the question, as we have it in front of us right now, is if we live longer, hurt less, and earn more, and are more afraid, why is that? One window in that's legitimate, I think, is to suggest that fear is pervasive today because fear is profitable. Now, to put it into a short sentence, fear sells. I'm a CBC radio listener, and one of the recurring news stories 2 weeks ago was about this rather large glacier about the size of Prince Edward Island that calved off the Larsen ice shelf in Antarctica. And I happened to hear this interview on CBC with a scientist whose daily work, how'd your day go today, Mom? Whose daily work is watching satellite images of this glacier. You know, we use the term glacial to describe speed because of, anyway, so she's been watching this crack, you know, change for years. And she was stoked about this glacier calving. She was just like, she was just super excited. She's like, "You've been watching this for years. We've been waiting for it to happen, and it happened, and we were watching when it happened." And she was just like, "Woohoo!" You know. And the interviewer, however, could not seem to abandon the line of questioning about what sort of calamity this either was or would become. And even when the scientist pointedly responded with, I think, the reasonable observation that this is not a bizarre event, and that it's far too soon to know anything concrete about how this berg is going to behave or what the implications of that, the interviewer just kept like bashing away at this theme. And generally speaking, I'm a CBC fan. As I said, I find the overall quality of the journalism to be pretty high. I turned this one off. That was not, by the way, an act of denial about climate change or sea level change or plastic gyres in the middle of the sea or any number of other verifiable issues and problems. It was an act of resistance to the culture of fear. That's consciously why I turned off that story. I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I move through this world with enough imagination and awareness of my own fragility that I do not need someone to use the leverage of broadcast technology to fire hose me with the perspective that apocalypse is imminent. I just don't. And if, I mean, I get it, fear sells, but I'm an actor in this story and not a victim, and if I don't want the media to sell me fear, I know how to find the off button. But I think that's one of the reasons why fear is pervasive. It sells. And to offer a little bit of contextual balance, it's not just the media that puts fuel on the fear fire. Of course, it happens in politics. It happens in product marketing. It happens when our friends warn us about the latest health scare or food allergy or crime epidemic. And frankly, it's been a pretty popular tool in the religion toolbox as well. I have found myself quite deeply saddened by my encounters with this, not least of all here at the table. The way it often shows up in my experience is by somebody saying something about an idea like, can we do that? Can we say that? Can we talk about that? Can we sing that? What's going to happen if we do? Really, actually, what's going to happen if we do? I am going to resist the temptation to get passionately sidetracked at this point because this really gets under my skin. Not when people do it. Like, it's not like you're getting under my skin if you do it. That's not the way it gets under my skin. All I'm going to say about it today is that for those of you who might have grown up around the idea that we can legitimately measure someone's Christian spirituality by ticking off a list. And in this particular case, a famous list for this is the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, long-suffering, blah, 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 that whole list, right? So that we can kind of cue that up and go, how's your spirituality doing? Well, let's see. How's the evidence of this and this and this? And we can, if you grew up around that, then the one thing you need to keep in mind is what's not on that list. You know what is not on that list? Conformity is not on that list. Conformity, people, is not, from the biblical text perspective, a fruit of the Spirit, if you're using that list. Religious conformity is not a product of curiosity or exploration of belief or of the continuing, honest, adult conversation about big questions. Conformity is a product, often in a religious setting, of intimidation and of fear. So, the culture of fear can be profoundly present in the exact sort of communities that are espousing faith as an antidote to fear. That's a problem. So is, I think, the simplistic and nonsensical notion that if we have faith, we should not experience fear. Right? I think we just need to try to put paid to that and then we can carry on. More on that another day. Maybe we'll also explore some ways that religions sometimes cultivate environments of learned helplessness. Something that religion, Christianity not least of all, has a deep, robust history of doing. In any case, we're just getting started. There's lots of directions we could take this exploration. Next week, what we're going to do in part is we're going to poke around a little bit in the philosophy of Zygmunt Bauman. He's Polish. I probably did him an injustice just then. Contemporary philosopher, died this past January. But this is the guy who has given us, in this conversation about fear, the term liquid fear. An interesting idea set behind that we're going to explore a little bit. He calls that kind of fear a crisis of humanity. And I think there's some really strong linkages between his thinking about that kind of fear and fear-based spirituality. So we'll kind of touch on some of that next week. But this morning, just a couple of observations about some of the ways that these ideas connect with our perceptions of God. If you grew up in the Christian tradition, and when I look around this room, I think about the stories I know, most of us in the room this morning did, then you know by experience, among other things, that the core perceptions of the nature of God in that religious tradition are most often rooted in biblical texts and in the interpretation of those texts. And I find it intriguing to observe how the perception of the nature of the divine evolves in those texts as that collection of poems and writings and letters unfolds over time. And this has to do with the way we understand the relationship between the divine and the nature of fear. So that's why we're talking about it. So to really paint with a broad, kind of quick brush, that collection of stories starts out with all that is coming into being under the blessing of God. Good, 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 very good. I'm overwhelmed with good, I need a day off. Oh yeah, there's a curse. Ever wonder how we got that story so upended? Anyway, so that's how the story starts. And then the story goes on, in fairly short order, to start to wrestle with accounting for suffering. See, if you are an ancient, and you imagine the world coming into existence by a being greater than you can conceive of, opening their mouth and the world pouring out, which is sort of how that story goes, then somehow, in a story like that, everything that you're experiencing poured out of that mouth. God spoke, boom, everything poured out. But growing food is hard work. Having babies hurts, and sometimes the babies die, and sometimes the mother doesn't survive. It's scary. There are large things that eat you if you're not careful. If you are careful and skillful, then you get to eat them. Life is hard. Is a cultural misappropriation for me to tell a story about a First Nations t-shirt that I saw in a First Nations context on my summer holidays that was about this part of life that I thought was insanely funny because of its context? We stopped for fuel. We're in Alberta, nowhere in BC, somewhere. We stopped at this gas station that was run by a local band. They also had a store, convenience store there, and they had some various things in the store, including a number of t-shirts. The one that cracked us up for about an hour on the drive after we left was Indian, their words, Indian definition for vegetarian, lousy hunter. So if you're good, you get to eat them. If you're not, they eat you. All right, some of that still, there's an echo, right? So the story, starts to try to make an account for the suffering. How do we understand the suffering? How do we understand this, right? So both there's the everyday kind, the growing food is hard and having babies is painful. How do we understand that? And then there's sort of the more everyday but more egregious sort. So the story starts to wrestle with how do we know and do what's right? How can we tell what's not right? And it starts to tell stories about the cataclysm that comes from harmful choices, choices like estrangement and comparing ourselves to others and anger and murder. So the story is just like going, how do we make sense of this? And how do we make sense of our experience that there's something behind the thing behind the thing that is too big for us to get our arms around? It's too big for us to get our story around. What do we do with this? And then that story unfolds into the story of a tribe, of a particular group of people, and this idea that God might be one rather than many, an idea that that tribe borrowed from a neighboring tribe, but it became rather prevalent about that point in history. And then out of that, in the story, comes the possibility that maybe if God was one, then maybe that one could belong to a particular tribe. The problem's obvious, isn't it? Like the neighboring tribe has the same idea, but a different name for the divine. So now we've got competing ones. Anyway, but that's what the story wrestles with, right? This is a huge chunk of the Hebrew story. Really important. That idea, though, that if God is one, then that one might belong to a particular tribe, that idea doesn't stay unchallenged, even within the Hebrew text. And this is a rather lovely part of this text to me, because all you have to do is spend a few minutes in the Psalms and listen to the psalmist rhapsodizing about trees clapping their hands and oceans vocalizing and all kinds of, that God is just present in all sorts of places to the poet, not just in the unspeakable name, which intriguingly in Hebrew, if you actually try to say the phonetic name of God in Hebrew, it ends up being the sound of an exhalation. It's the same sound as breath. The word sounds like breath. Anyway, so that sort of starts to happen inside of the text, right? Inside of the story. And then if you're still kind of wondering if that idea is legitimately getting challenged there, spend some time with the prophets. What do you think Isaiah might have been after when he writes that the whole earth is filled with the glory of God? Or if we move over into the Christian part of the story, what's Paul gesturing toward when he talks about all of creation groaning, trying to bring something new to be? And then Jesus comes along and does this rather vigorous job of pointing out that no single religion can possibly contain the goodness of God. And that idea gets quite a reaction. And so we find ourselves wrestling with this culture of fear and with our own fears in this sometimes complicated world that's a complex mix of the wonderful and the terrible and the beautiful and the confounding and of things we can grasp and influence and things that are beyond our grasp. It's not new, this wrestling. But it is challenging. So how do we proceed in a world like that? Well, this isn't an answer in the sense of here are three steps to make your fears vanish. If you want that sermon, you have to go to a different church. But I think there is something that we can do today or any day that can make a difference in our life experience of a world where that kind of culture is happening and we're in it. We are not, this is just an aside, we are not our culture. But we are immersed in our culture. If fish in water helps, that helps me. When I think about myself in the context of culture, that's the image that I find most resonant. It's my environment. I take it in. I take my life from it. But I'm not it. I'm surrounded by it. It's inescapable. Not meant to escape it. So if our culture, if our surrounding culture has this pervasive fear current in it, what can we do to live there and to live better there? Well, one of the things that we can do is take seriously the possibility that the divine invites us to moments of rest in the middle of that cultural reality. Not in denial of that culture, but in the midst of it. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to start with the Coburn song. Because when Coburn talks about, there's not very many known quotes on his website, which is fairly tediously documented in some cases in terms of what he has said about his songs. He hasn't said that much about this one publicly. But one of the things that he has said is that what he was thinking about was just what it feels like when life pops you in the mouth, like slugs you in the face. The verse about everything's ambiguous except the taste of blood, that's about that. It's about getting punched in the mouth. So the verses are all about those kind of challenges, right? Really hard things, things that just level you. And then the chorus is, lie down, take your rest with me. And the image of the South, if we take it seriously, if we think about what the songwriter said, this is an invitation to rest in the midst of conflict, of family upheaval, of war, of uncertainty, of injustice, of poverty, of death. Pick a Civil War image from that war in the South. And then imagine being invited to rest in the midst of it, and you've got the context for in the South. Okay? The invitation is to find rest, to sense the beauty that is present. Night blooms perfume the breeze. Do you think that stopped in the middle of that war? Do you think the night blooms cashed it in? Do you think the iron taste of blood got into the air in a way that made it not perfumed by the breeze? I don't think so. I think they coexisted. I think the reality of the suffering and the invitation to rest coexisted. Then, and I think, they coexist now. So this is an invitation to allow the beauty that is present, even in the middle of suffering, to speak to our fears so that we can move toward a life in which, even while we're encountering all the kinds of challenges that that song reminds us of, that we experience outside of that, even in the midst of that, we're able to attend, perhaps ever so briefly, to what is lovely and to what is good, and to move with a different sort of, I wrote the word ease in my notes, and I don't like it because it's too facile, but with a different sort of spirit through those challenges, because we have chosen to accept the invitation to moments of rest, of just breathing in the goodness and the beauty of the divine, which is present even in, perhaps especially in, the midst of the things that we can't know or control. We're going to sing in a moment. And one of the songs we're going to sing together is a song of Jamie's that I just love. Because it's about this. Because it says so straightforwardly and so beautifully both that in the midst of things that that can level us as people. The invitation to rest is extended, and the invitation to profoundly know the presence of God through that suffering is extended as well. And I think that's a good, right, and true picture of our life experience and a beautiful invitation. So that's all I'm going to say about that. That's enough talking. Let's sing. Next week, we're here in this location. We will spend a little bit of time on popular philosophy. It won't hurt much.